And you may proceed when you're ready, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Raymond Wilson. I represent plaintiffs and appellants CMB Export LLC, CMB Infrastructure Group 9, and CMB Infrastructure Group 11. The right to a trial by jury is the great constitutional right. It's only in exceptional cases and for specific causes that a party may be deprived of it. While parties can contract their way out of the right to a trial by jury under the FAA, their contract must be clear in its intent to do so and unambiguous. In this case, despite all of the plaintiffs and all of the defendants for claims 2 through 5 having no agreement to arbitrate, the defendants moved and the lower court granted the motion to compel arbitration, which deprived CMB Group 9 of its rights to a trial by jury, discovery, and its rights to compel witnesses to testify at the hearing on the issues presented. The primary question facing the court here today, I believe, is will this court be the first in the entire country to enforce an arbitration agreement when no party on either side of the V agreed to it? Again, the only signatories to the arbitration agreement that was enforced by the lower court were Group 11, Cobra Finance, and Cobra Instalaciones. My colleagues on the other side point towards their reliance and the lower court's reliance on the separate reporting requirements under Group 11's contract, and they allege that Group 9 was relying on that, and that's one of the basis or bases for the enforcement of the arbitration agreement under Group 11's contract. However, there are separate reporting requirements under Group 9, Group 9's agreement, which required the exact same reports that Group 11's contract did. Defendants cite to no case where no party on either side of the V agreed or failed to agree to an arbitration where an arbitration was enforced. The cases that they relied upon had at least one party on either side having agreed to it, enforcing it against a non-agreeing party.
Counsel, I want to back up a minute for something that you just said about that the reporting requirements were the same under both loan contracts. If that was true, why is it? I mean, I read your complaint to focus a lot on the disclosures required under the Group 11 contract. And I think that the reason for that is because of the timing of what was going on and what was being financed by the two different loans. But so does that matter? I mean, it does seem like the complaint focuses a lot on the obligations owed under Group 11, and that Group 9's allegations are that it was disadvantaged, it was harmed in its ability to mitigate or protect itself because of stuff that was not happening under the Group 11 contract.
Yes, and I believe the court is right in pointing that out, that the complaint focuses heavily on Group 11's contract, but a complaint for damages only needs to put the other side on notice of the allegations being made against it. It's not the end-all, be-all. Should this case have proceeded, there would have been exposition that both Group 9 and Group 11 had those reporting requirements. Group 9's claims 2 through 5, relied upon those reporting requirements and the failure to report those.
But at this stage of the case, we're looking at the pleadings, right? And I think the parties agree New York law applies, and New York does have some of these estoppel theories. And so it seems like one of those theories would suggest that if you are a party who is seeking to benefit from a contract that includes an arbitration provision, and you're expressly doing that in setting out your case and your theory and your claims, then you can be tagged with having to arbitrate because there's you can't pick and choose the pieces of the contract that you yourself are bringing to bear in the case. Why is that wrong?
I don't think it's wrong in isolation, but if you're looking at the posture of the parties, each party has its own ability to contract for an arbitration agreement. They did contract for it under the Group 11 contract. The negotiating parties under Group 9 chose not to. And the combination of the claims in the complaint were for the convenience of the parties, particularly my clients, in wanting to get all of the claims out and handled at once to try to get to a resolution. It wasn't so much we're relying entirely on Group 11's contract. There were two separate contracts that were alleged. There are two separate contracts that were attached to the complaint, and claims 2 through 5 were solely the claims of the Group 9 plaintiffs. Furthermore, I think what Your Honor brings up regarding the equitable enforcement, equity can't override statute. And the FAA and the arbitration agreements under New York law say that you must have a clear, unambiguous contract to arbitrate in order for an arbitration to be enforced. And without that, the use of the equity should have, or the equitable consideration should have fallen back on the basic, was there a clear, unambiguous agreement between the parties to the Group 9 contract to arbitrate their disputes? And there was not in this case.
Well, I guess I come back to something that you said sort of at the beginning of the disclosure obligations were the same under the two contracts. If that was really true, then why is the complaint so focused on the disclosure obligations of Group 11 loan contract?
I don't have a good answer to that question, Your Honor. A mistake in drafting the complaint or an unintentional focus on Group 11 only or a majority focus on Group 11's contract shouldn't deprive Group 9's rights to a trial by jury.
Did you ever ask the district court for the ability to amend so that you could clarify that you're really just asserting rights under the Group 9 loan?
To my understanding, there was no request of that nature. I may be wrong, but I don't recall seeing that in the record. Does the panel have any further questions? If not, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And counsel, not to get you off track with your argument, but your opposing counsel just said this is the first time in the history of the United States. If you could tell us either why that's true and that's fine or why that's not true at some point in your argument, that'd be great.
Sure. Good morning. May it please the court, Philip Robin, counsel for the appellees. Sort of bring things back where we see it, rightly belongs. I mean, this appeal raises a really very narrow question as we see it. Can the appellants plead claims built on disclosure obligations under the Group 11 loan agreement and guarantee, duties, and then avoid arbitration under those agreements by bringing in non-signatories to those agreements as plaintiffs and defendants? The answer is no, they can't do that. It's well established that when parties agree to arbitrate disputes, they can't skirt those obligations by bringing in non-signatories to those agreements, by bringing in those types of parties.
Well, that makes sense when you've got at least one side of the agreement involved in the litigation. But here the point is that nobody who was party to the contract that actually had the arbitration term is involved. I mean, they're sort of involved because there's relationships between these different entities, but in terms of the direct signatories, they're not here. And doesn't that make a difference?
Well, that's not true. They are here. They are here. Group 11 is a signatory. CMB Export's a signatory. They were plaintiffs.
I guess I'm overstating it. Fair enough. But there are certain claims in this case that do not involve a signatory.
I would take issue with that as well. I mean, they group pled the whole entire complaint. I mean, it says plaintiffs, plaintiffs, plaintiffs as to every count, and makes the you know, they somewhat will, you know, state the claims, you know, against certain defendants, some of whom are non-signatories, some of whom are not, some of whom are, but they you know, on every claim, there's at least one signatory to the claim as a plaintiff, and on all but one claim, there's at least one signatory as a defendant as well. So there isn't non-signatories on, you know, on the claims on both sides. But getting to the question that Judge Owens raised, this would not be the first time that there were non-signatories on both sides of a case. You know, CMB says, you know, we cite no case where non-signatories have been on both sides of a case. That's not true. In fact, the district court cited a case that had non-signatories on both sides. It's Lapina. Lapina versus Metro versus Women New York. That case had non-signatories on both sides. Now, it had a signatory. Lapina was a signatory. But a company associated with her, Gingin, was a non-signatory. And they brought together claims against a whole bunch of defendants, including Women New York. Women New York was a non-signatory. There was at least one other defendant that was a signatory. That signatory had a contract. And they brought claims against other defendants, including Women New York, that was a non-signatory. And Women New York moved to compel arbitration. The court said, yes, you can compel arbitration, including as to Gingin, the non-signatory plaintiff. Another case we cited, Meridian Autonomous, same similar situation. Going outside of the cases, because they said that they couldn't find any other cases involving appellate courts, in 2023, the Nevada Supreme Court, in an en banc decision, it's called RUAG, R-U-A-G, Amotech GmbH versus Archon Firearms, 538 Pacific Reporter 3rd, 428, held that non-signatories can compel arbitration or be compelled to arbitrate against other non-signatories. You know, I that case actually cites the district court's case in a footnote. It's footnote 4. It doesn't cite it on that principle of law. It cites it on the principle that once you've found that you can, you know, that non-signatories can compel arbitration by estoppel, then you can use a the a delegation clause to have the arbitrators determine the scope of arbitration. In New York, there's a case called Belchikov versus XTP Implementation Services, Inc. It's 232 New York Supplement 3rd, 196. That was decided by the Appellate Division of New York. That's our mid-level appellate court in New York. There's also Rivas versus Schwartz, 140 New York Supplement 3rd, 68, also the Appellate Division of New York. There's another case, ColorWeb, Inc. versus Mitsubishi Heavy Industries Printing and Packaging Machinery, 2016 Westlaw 683-7156. That's the Southern District of New York in November of 2016. Those are just some cases where there's non-signatories on both sides. They're usually combined with signatories because it's a similar situation to here where you have a signatory plaintiff with some affiliated entity claiming against signatory defendants along with non-signatory defendants. So it's a very similar situation. And, you know, the claims here, they all relate to the Group 11 agreement. And I think, you know, the reason, Judge Forrest, you asked this, you know, why is the complaint so focused on Group 11 and not Group 9? It's because none of the appellees here are parties to the Group 9 agreement. They're only parties to the Group 11 agreement. So there really would be no claim that they could bring against the under the Group 9 agreement as to these appellees. They just, it would be impossible to state, really. It would be kind of laughable. So they had to bring a claim against these parties that they could link up to this contract in some way. And that's why they had to state it in the way that they did, because they would have no connection to them other than through Group 11. So that's you know, why we think they did that. I think it's important also to, you know, point out what's not at issue here. You know, they've conceded that arbitration as to their first claim was appropriate, that they should have never brought that claim in federal court. It was perfectly arbitrable. They also, I think, concede that arbitration of the other claims as to the signatory defendants was appropriate. That's maybe why they don't talk about them very much. So that would be Group 11 and CMB Export. They don't speak about them because they seem to concede that arbitration as to those would have been okay. Also, I heard my friend on the other side. He's talking about, you know, procedural issues and, you know, and trying to stress that it's important to have a jury trial or a right to a jury trial. You know, talking about, you know, right to disclosure, a right to, you know, compel witnesses. You know, none of that is in their briefs, as far as I can tell. But none of that is on appeal here because, you know, we're not talking about, you know, whether arbitration, you know, the arbitrator's decision was appropriate or not. We're talking about whether they were properly compelled to arbitrate. And, you know, under the principles that the district court applied, they surely were. They, you know, all three plaintiffs, including Group 9, you know, claim through that agreement, and they can't avoid the arbitration clause that they claimed through.
Do you agree with your friend on the other side that the disclosure agreements or the disclosure obligations were the same under the two contracts?
They're certainly. I think they're very similar, but I mean I haven't compared them, you know, line by line. But they were similar, but I don't think that helps them. I think, you know, that borrower had obligations. We had obligations. They sued under the obligations that were in the contract related to our contract. They didn't sue under that contract because we are not parties to that contract. We were parties to the Group 11 contract, and they cite it throughout. I mean, if you look at the allegations, you know, for example, I'm just picking one out. I mean, you know, related to say their intentional interference claim, they say, you know, they refer in paragraph 144 of their complaint. They're required to disclose pursuant to the indebtedness to group 11. In the second claim, you know, they refer back to the obligations to disclose to Group 11 and CMB Export. Those are the obligations that are under the Group 11 agreement. In their third count. You know, if you look at the, you know, the allegations that are in the, you know, the counts, they refer to an obligation to disclose this contractual event. But earlier in the complaint, in paragraph 90, it's on page 661 and 62 of the record excerpts. In paragraph 90, they make it clear they're talking about an obligation to disclose under the Group 11 agreement. In paragraph 139, they talk about, you know, they say, well, there's aiding and abetting because the you know, all the appellees encouraged Cobra Finance, which is the party to the Group 11 agreement, not to make disclosures, requisite disclosures, to CMB Export and Group 11. Those disclosures were required under the Group 11 agreement. They tie back all the claims to that agreement. And, you know, that is what, you know, the district court looked at. That's what the district court saw in deciding that all of those plaintiffs could be required to arbitrate with these defendants. You know, it was a correct application of the direct benefits estoppel principle under New York law.
Do you think that we have to apply both the direct benefit estoppel and the alter ego estoppel theories?
I think that it just helps to establish both ways. You know, the direct benefits that takes all of takes Group 9, and I, you know, to the extent they're claiming that CMB Export is not a signatory, the direct benefits brings them in, and the the alter ego estoppel, you know, prevents them from denying that, that the non-signatories on the defendant's side can't take advantage of the agreement arbitration clause the other way. It's not necessarily that you have to find that they are alter egos. You just, they can't say that these entities are alter egos for the purposes of their claim and then say, well, but for purposes of this analysis, they're all separate entities that can't take advantage of it.
Is there any New York precedent that applies both of these theories in the same case?
I'm trying to think if one of the cases I mentioned before does. I don't remember if there's a if a New York case specifically that applies them both in the same case. I mean, there are certainly cases that apply them. I mean, you know, the Smith-Enron case we cite applies that alter ego principle in that way. But you know, just by way of example, I mean, I think that the Ruegg case I mentioned, you know, the way it approaches this is that you can apply these types of principles. You know, it cites to the Thompson case, which is where these two, I think these two principles are articulated. That says you can apply them both because they you deal from one from one side, one from the other side, is how I read it. And you can establish the estoppel from both ends and apply them in the same case. And I think that's an appropriate way to. Look at the estoppel principle because it's looking to see, you know, can you fairly compel a party to arbitrate, and where they've asserted claims against parties under an agreement, it's fair to do that, and I think that would be fair here. If there's no other questions, we'd respectfully request that you affirm the district court.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I believe that each of the cases cited by my colleague are distinguishable in that there was always either a mixture of claims between at least one party that had something to do with an arbitration agreement and parties on the other side who did not, or one party on one side of the V along with other parties on the other side of the V. Or on that same side of the V, one's a signatory, other plaintiffs are not enforcing an arbitration agreement one way or the other. I think there is a bevy of case law interpreting arbitration agreements against and holding them against non-signatories, but there is always at least one party that signed away their rights or signed away the rights of their heirs or their assigns. In this case, for claims 2 through 5, there's only CMB Group 9. And CMB Group 9 was suing a bevy of defendants. Neither one, through claims 2 through 5, on both sides of the V, there is no signatory to an arbitration agreement. My colleague indicated that Group 9 itself didn't have claims. Group 9 is an appellee here and the one that is making the primary argument before you here today.
I mean, a weak point to the point that you just made is that the plaintiff's own allegations in this case say that the defendants are all alter egos of each other. So to stand on formality is a little bit difficult when you are alleging in the complaint that all of that formality is sort of false.
I agree. It's a difficult position to make, but the position that my colleagues are advancing and that the district court used was using two different types of equity rationale to pull in non-signatories and bind them to an arbitration agreement that was never discussed, never agreed to. It's using multiple different theories of binding arbitration in a way that I don't think, and I, again, may be wrong, but I did do quite a bit of research in briefing this, that I don't believe has ever been done before in this country to this extent. I believe the court has all of the arguments that I wish to make, both in writing and in orally. And if there's no further questions, I'd like to thank you and my colleagues for their time.
Thank you very much to both the parties for their briefing and argument in this case. This matter is submitted. And this panel is adjourned until tomorrow at, I believe, Ms. Lawler, 9 a.m. 9 a.m. tomorrow. Thank you, everyone.